I was thinking and just reading a bit about Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the declaration that was read earlier. She's probably best known for the Battle Hymn of Republic. She wrote that, and I think it's ironic, the two positions of the songs and of her life. However, she really was dedicated more so toward peace than war, certainly, and she worked to end slavery. She initiated the women's movement at many states. She organized the international peace movement. But what I think more pertaining to today's sermon is important to recognize what she said about her dedication to the peace movement, her dedication to the rights of women, her dedication of going against and in a way the narrative of that particular culture. When she saw the values of the culture she was in, and she saw the narrative of the culture she was in, she said, there's a problem here, and it's oppressive to women, and it's oppressive to the poor, and it's oppressive to others, and that we need to do something about that. And her words upon reflection about engaging in those activities were these: when to do so was a thankless office involving public ridicule and private avoidance. And her celebration of Mother's Day as a peace day went on for a number of years, but eventually gave way to a Mother's Day that celebrated mothers in such a way that forgot her intent to stand over and against war. And I want that, if we can, to be a theme, that when we move against a worldview, that when we move against a narrative of a culture that has values that's oppressive, it is a thankless position. It is a position of ridicule and often a position of persecution. And we look at our spiritual leaders throughout time, and we often see that people who stood up over and against oppressive values, that they were killed, assassinated, done away with. So today, I want to address the movement in the Unitarian Universalist Association to shift the language that we use as a community and as a people. I guess Bill Sinkford, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, has said we are to return to a language and reclaim a language from our past. Is the emphasis, and it is called the language of reverence. The language that we have forgotten, a vocabulary of reverence. And I thought I would read two pieces to kind of put this in context and then explore some thoughts as Unitarian Universalists. What does that mean for us? What does it mean that we've gotten to a place that our leaders say to us, we need to go back to the place where we were before to really claim our true power, therefore implying where we are now is problematic, therefore implying whoever led us here did not do a good job, because we've got to abandon that leadership in that direction and go back and reclaim something about ourselves and move off in another direction. One of my concerns is that whenever we go back and claim language of the past, we incorporate the language of the past and we go back to the past, and often 30 years later we end up back at the very same place that we have retreated from. Because we have battled this language of the humanist language and language that had evolved through times. We battled with this in 1867 as an association, the 1920s, the 1930s, and here we are again. And it's very similar to what we went through at those two eras of time. So what are we up to? Okay. The Reverend David Bombaugh said this in 2003. We have manned the ramparts. And for any modern day feminist person of language, right away, I mean, I just think, in my face, okay? Anyway, we have manned the ramparts of reasons and are prepared to defend the citadel of the mind, but in the process we have lost the ability to speak that which was sacred, holy, of ultimate importance to us, the language that would allow us to enter into critical dialogue with the religious community. Now, some of this is about that the Unitarian Universalist Association has not grown since Unitarian Universalists joined in the 60s. And the population of the nation has certainly increased. And I believe now our numbers are less than 200,000. We simply have not grown. So part of this shift in the language is a recognition of that and is an attempt to put us in a position to grow. He's also saying that we have lost our place in the religious community, so we need to regain this language in order to come back into the dialogue with the religious community. And when we look back over the past 30 years, we can see that in a way, liberal religious communities have not been a dominant religious voice in our culture, clearly. President Sinkford's response was this. During the presidency of William Sinkford, the debate within the UU movement has roiled over, and he's called to return to an authentic Unitarian Universalist language of reverence, an authentic language of reverence. Sinkford has suggested that Unitarian Universalists have abandoned traditional religious language. Have we abandoned language, traditional, or have we evolved to a different place and time? He doesn't address why he uses the word abandon and how we got to where we are. Thereby abandoning words with potential power to others who will dictate their meanings in the public sphere. He continues to quote, "I would like to see us to become better acquainted with the depths so that we are more grounded in our personal faith so that we can effectively communicate that faith and what we believe it demands of us and others. For this, I think we need to cultivate what Minister David Bombaugh calls a vocabulary of reverence. The Unitarian side of our family tells us that there is only one God, the Spirit of life, the power of love. The Universalist side tells us that God is a loving God, condemning no one, and valuing the spark of divinity in all human beings. So, Unitarian Universalism, by definition, stands for one God and no one left behind." That's the language of the leadership of the Unitarian Universalist Association in an attempt to shift the language of our community. First thing I noticed that it's not a community movement, grassroots movement moving up that I can tell. It's more of a movement of leaders decided we needed to go in this direction and we're going to move this language into the community. The meaning of that is debatable, and I'm not sure exactly what that means, except I get suspicious as a Congregationalist and as belong to a church of local autonomy as the polity. I get suspicious when meaning comes from top down as opposed to grassroots up. But suspicion's good. I thought that it would be helpful to set this movement that we're having, this language of reverence, this moving, because language is extremely important, because ultimately the language we use is reshapes our inner world, our dialogue, and sets our values, then coordinates our behavior and what we do in this world. Language is important. So I thought I would set it in the context of where we live today and what's happened in the past 60 or 70 years so that we can put what's going on in our association in its cultural context a bit. And the first thing I would like to say is that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, our culture shifted from a culture who believed in character formation. And you can remember those words, that we've got to build character in our young people so that we can become solid citizens, so citizens can think for themselves, and so forth. Our job is to build character. Something happened in the 1920s and 30s, and if you go back and you read many of the psychologists, they suggest that at that particular point in time, we became outer-directed. Character formation is inner-directed, paying attention to our inner values. Outer-directed is not so. We gain our values from the outside world without really paying attention to our inner world. And this came about when the seeds of consumerism and when the power and awareness of the marketing community were alerted to, we can manipulate the minds of people to get them to buy what we want them to buy without really negotiating openly and honestly. So we're going to create a way that creates people's imaginations to be outer directed, so we don't reflect on who we are as individual human beings, and the symbol system, the marketing process out here will determine how people will act, and we will move our culture to be a consuming, to be a culture of consuming. The result of that was that a term came to life. It was called the good personality. We as citizens, we as human beings, became the commodity. We began a process of adjusting ourselves so that as we walked in this new economic system of consumerism, we could sell ourselves for jobs and to our community. People would walk into churches, not necessarily to belong to a church, but they'd be real estate agents and psychotherapists and such to belong in a community for a referral process rather than for their own internal mature cultivation, building the community that way. We began to sell ourselves. The theologian Paul Tillich, I believe he coined the word, it was called thingification. We became things among things. The historical context is we become outer-directed. I mean, and we look at today, I mean, that process has matured. I mean, you just think about news channels, 24/7, pay attention. I mean, think about the trial of O.J. Simpson and all that stuff that we're glued to the television. We're kind of addicted to what's going on, and our attention's out there. It's out there. It's out there. And then when we do stop and reflect, what are the things we see? We see images of the outside world in our minds. We're not in touch with our own selves. I can remember sitting down to a meditation, and I don't know if any of you have ever seen the show 24 with Keith or Sullivan. It's very intense and it's very bright and it's aggressive. And I sat down for this meditation. I could not escape the images of that show, and my meditation became a process of escaping television images so I could get in touch with myself and be relaxed with myself, because my mind was filled up with these images from the entertainment world. Entertainment becoming history, all kinds of things. So we know that I think is a given, that there is a great effort in our culture to keep our minds out here. That's just part of who we are. The next thing is there is now a psychological group of people that Christopher Bolas, a theorist, calls the normotics. The normotics are people who are excessively normal. When we are so oriented to the outward world and conforming to the outward world, we will become excessively normal. Because our comparison and our reference points to the outside world will conform to that. So he calls those folks excessively normal. The important dynamic of the excessively normal person is there's no inner subjective life, no individual self-reflective meaning-making process going on, meaning always coming from the outside world in. That is determining who we are and how we're going to be, which fits perfectly with being outer-directed. So I think in a culture, that's where we find ourselves. We also, before we get to the reverence, we also know this from history, that for at least the past 4,000 years, we can find a spiritual process in history in which spiritual people from India, from Asia, from the Middle East, from Europe, from the United States, when we can look at a historical trail, and we can see this model emerging, that within the human being, there are two poles, this spiritual tradition would suggest. The first pole is that part of us who stands at the forefront, who that part of me that looks out, sees my family, sees the community, sees friends, is back in touch with a place where I have enjoyed myself and engaged with people in this community, and that front part is outward directed because I'm looking, it is outward directed, and engages the world, decides what I'm going to say, really has some value systems, but it's in the forefront and it's engaging and it's out here. My decision-making process is out here. When I'm outer directed, that part of me is referencing reality to the outer directed process, symbol system, cultural values, or whatever. But these folks have said that there is a place within the human beings that's, and I really don't know how to say it, except I'll say it like this, but the nuances and the full meaning of it, I'm not sure, but is in back, in a way. That we have this front part that's engaging, but there's this part of us that is back here, that we can be in touch with or not. Now, I noticed the language that has been used to describe this part of the human being in this spiritual process that's in back of this ego, that's in back of this front engaging part. We're still within the human imagination. We're still within the human frame. And these are some of the words to describe that. Perfect nature, Holy Spirit, Son of God, Angel of Gabriel, Philosopher's Angel, Divine Essence, Guide of Light. Now, when you hear those words, given my Baptist history, when I hear Holy Spirit, I don't think about something that's innately within me. I think about indwelling of the Holy Spirit coming from God. I think about an external process. I don't think about an internal process at first. Okay. But when we think about those words in our culture, those words usually kind of reference an outer process. An angel. That's outer, descending, however you want to say it. But however, when we look at the spiritual tradition that's 4,000 years old, that runs through different religious traditions, runs through different eras of time, runs from different continents, and are similar from different peoples, we hear this inner description of who we are in terms of angels, philosophers' angels, the Holy Spirit, the Son of God, the Son of Man. We hear all these things, but it's not talking about an external process. It's not talking about an external God. It's talking about our inner world. And they're talking about that when we are in touch with that inner world, the best that we can be as spiritual and as human beings is when that part of us, again, that's kind of in back of that front engaging part, finds its way through that front part of us and influences our behavior and how we engage the world. That's the spiritual journey according to this tradition. Buddha found compassion there. Jesus found love there. Prophets from the Jewish tradition found justice there. This is where we find the qualities described by these spiritual traditions that are good for what it means to be human. That are not oppressive, not cruel, not mean, not hurtful. But movements of compassion, movements of love, movements of justice. When we hear those voices, we hear from those spiritual beings that stand, that have that part, that are in a process, a spiritual process that engage that part that's within back, and that has found a way to move through the internalized culture. It's found a way to move through that ego that battles for a position in this world. It's a movement to go within. It's not a movement that moves us outward. That is the first movement. Within ourselves. Now back to the language of reverence. Moving from we respect that we are part of the web of existence to we are in reverence to being part of the web of existence. Both of those words are outer directed. We have respect for, we have reverence for. What really raised the flag for me is when I looked up the definition of reverence, which if you're going to talk about language of reverence, you should probably look up the word of reverence. When I looked up the word of reverence, it said, held in reverence, particularly used for clergymen. And I thought, wait a minute, I might like that reverence. I might enjoy that, you know, I might feel like Rodney Dangerfield. I want to enjoy them. It's outer directed. Reverence for nature. Reverence for the web of existence. Respect for It draws our attention outward. H. Richard Niebuhr, a Christian theologian, I think gave us a good model that we can apply in different directions. He wrote a book, and it was called Christ and Culture. And he went through five categories. It was Christ against culture, Christ transforming culture, Christ of culture, Christ accommodating culture. And what he was letting us know, that you could take your highest value and put it in any one of those categories. And so we could say Unitarian Universalism, of culture, transforming culture, against culture. We could do that. And so it became a reference point for me, is that when I'm processing something, I'll use those five categories and say, is this a movement of accommodation? Is this a movement of conformity? Is this a movement of transformation? Is this a movement of change? What is it a movement for? And when I think about the Unitarian Universalists, using the language, and this is the language I use, we are going to go back in history and reclaim our language. We're going to go back in history and reclaim territory we have given up. Whenever it has been my experience, whenever we move back in history and reclaim something, generally it's about the centralization of power. Because if we've moved through time and we've come to a point where there's greater diversity in the Unitarian Universalist Association, and we have great diversity in the Unitarian Universalist Association. I know the church where I minister at in Brevard, I think they did statistics, we have 40% theist, we have 30% agnostic, 30% atheist. I mean, we have a variety of people that all feel welcome there and that come there. And so when we're talking about this language, when we go back and reclaim this language, some people are having feelings about that. And if you read on the internet, the dialogue, some people have feelings about that. They're saying, what are we doing this for? So is it that we've abandoned language, or is it that we have evolved and where we are more welcoming to a greater diversity of people and perspectives? And is this movement back to reclaim this territory really a restrictive movement? Well, I think it's restrictive, myself. And it's alarming. And when I think of that model of Unitarian Universalism, of culture, conforming to culture, transforming culture, I think that we've come up to something. And certainly in the past 30 years, our values and our principles haven't been on the forefront of our culture as our culture has engaged the world and transformed. The inherent worth and dignity of every person, the search for truth and meaning, being part of the and honoring the inherent web of existence and treating nature gently. There's a country that just passed laws of the rights of nature. What's that country? Ecuador?
Yeah,
Ecuador. That nature has rights to thrive and to live. Imagine that. That's not on the forefront of our culture values. The Unitarian Universalist values have not been on the forefront. And so I agree that, and if our organization's not growing, I agree that we need to engage. What is the meaning of that? And maybe that if we're on the forefront, a different direction is called for. And maybe we need dialogue about that direction. Absolutely. But a regression that's exclusive, that would exclude people and offend people from where we are so that we can grow, seems to me not only, and when you look at history and when there has been a regression to reclaim the truths about who we are as a people, you find examples of nationalism. Not only is it a centralization of power, you often find scapegoats to be blamed for where we are in the here and now. These people are the problem. And if these people weren't part of us, we would be better off. I mean, you can go through history and find all kinds of examples like that. And it does not end well when it happens. I'd like to read a quote that may at first, well, it took me 10 times to begin to understand it. But I think I can read it and get through it. And I think it's very helpful at this point in time. It's by a philosopher, a man named Zizek. And I'll read the quote and then talk about it a bit and see how, if we can gain insight from this man's thinking and apply it to who we are as Unitarian Universalists to help give us some sense if the direction of the language of reverence, and maybe I'm wrong about that and would engage in conversation about that. If that's not the right move, I'm in agreement that maybe we need to change the direction or move, but if that's so, what should we do? What moves should we make, and how should we do that? And I think we can get some insight from this philosopher's thought. Žižek. In his project of overcoming metaphysics, Heidegger fully endorses the Nietzschean dismissal of quick and easy fixes from metaphysics. The only real way to break the metaphysical closure is to pass through it in its most dangerous form. To endure the pain of metaphysical nihilism at its most extremes, which means that one should reject as futile all false sedatives and direct attempts to suspend the mad, vicious cycle of modern technology by means of a return to a pre-modern, traditional... Pre-modern, traditional wisdom. From Christianity to Oriental thought. All attempts to reduce the threat of modern technology to the effect of some ontic social wrong, such as capitalism, patriarchal domination, these attempts are not only ineffectual, the true problem with them is this. On a deeper level, they incite the evil that they are fighting even further. Now, what does that mean? When he's talking about metaphysics, he's talking about a worldview. He's talking about a narrative and a symbol system that we use to understand our world. And he's saying that when you bump up against that worldview and you find that that worldview has problems, you can't find an easy, quick fix, a false sedative. You can't go back to a pre-time and gain the values of that pre-time and come back and deal with the here and now problems. Because the language and the story of the pre-time dealt with the problems of that day. They weren't constructed to deal with the problems of the day that they're now dealing with. You can't take the strategies of the 1950s and apply them to 2009 because it's a completely different world. It's like in the Buddha saying, you can't throw a rock in the same river twice. Not the same river. You can't use the answer here and bring it up here because it's a different river. It's different. And he's saying, so is it a question, going back and getting the language, a false sedative to make us feel good about ourselves because we are driven by an anxiety we don't know what to do in the here and now? When Julia Ward Howe said these words, when to do so, when to go up against the story, to go up against the narrative that's dominant, that we find problematic. When I have done this, she says, I find it to be a thankless place involving public ridicule and private avoidance. Žižek says that when we go up here and we challenge this, we will find a great amount of anxiety and we have to go through this worldview by way of destroying the worldview. So I got to thinking, what does a worldview mean anyway? What does that mean? And this is for me, is how I'm understanding it. Let's say I stand back here, and in my worldview, which I try to separate from my personal belief system, which you really can't, but for this example, I will. Okay, so for my worldview over here, I'll have some of the work and experiences of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I'll have some of the work and experiences of the teachings of the prophet Jesus. I'll have over here some of the works of the teachings of Buddha and Thich Nhat Hanh. I'll have over here some of the things that I've read about science and archaeology, the Dark Mother, where we go back 50,000 years trying to understand who the human being is when we first started to think symbolically.
first started to access the human capacity to symbolize, make narratives, and have the narratives determine who we're going to be. I think it's a good place to start. So when I bring in new information, I have these reference points out here, these beacon points out here. And these beacon points out where I have all these places, it's like it could be a ping pong ball, however we might want to look at that, but a piece of information will come in and I'll process it through this beacon, through this reference point, through this reference point, through this reference point, through this reference point, and it'll come back to me and I'll say, oh, well, that's interesting. I'll say, oh, no, I've got to get away from that. I'll say, well, no, that's that. But my worldview speaks to me. My worldview comes back to me. And we all have the worldview. What Žižek is saying is that in that worldview, we find a sense of belonging, we find a sense of comfort, we find a way to soothe our anxiety by having a particular worldview, and we got all these things in places in our imagination to help us remain the same through time so we can have a sense of continuity. We can engage one another, we can walk into church on Sunday, we can shake each other's hands, we can say hello to each other, we can remember each other. And it puts all those things together. He says, however, when he uses the term metaphysical closure, he says, however, no worldview is absolute truth. No worldview can be dominant through time and speak to every issue that we are going to face. He's saying that when we come up to a worldview that's no longer dealing with our present state and time and who we are as individuals and who we are as a community, we're not to go back to find an easy fix, a false sedative. Go back to find a time where we can soothe our anxiety to a time that once was. And most often, I expect many of us are old enough to know that we idealize those times, and when we go back, they're not so ideal. What he's saying is that we need to step up and we need to look at this. And in this closure of this worldview that we have confidence in, that gives us our sense of belonging, that soothes our anxiety, that helps us move through life, we've got to lay it down. I've got to lay Franklin Roosevelt down. I've got to lay science down. I've got to lay Jesus down. I've got to lay Buddha down. I've got to lay that down so in a sense I stand up and I have no beacons of reference. I have no reference points. And that is a very anxious place to be. But that is where the spiritual tradition that's 4,000 years old, that spans religious groups of people, when we step back and get in touch with that perfect nature, we step back and get in touch with that philosopher's angel, that's what we discover there. That we create with that front part of ourselves, we create that worldview in order to survive out here and engage this world out here. But this back part of that stands back here in a way informs us that we do that just to get along in this world. But eventually when this part of us, this spiritual part of us steps up and through, we can be healthy enough to lay down our worldview to an attempt to get an objective view of what's going on out here rather than being driven by the values of our history. We can use the values of our history, but we don't want to be driven by the values of our history. We want to be informed by the experiences of our history, but we don't want to be driven by the experiences of our history so that we can't see clearly what we're facing in the here and now and in the future. And it is possible that when we're stepping back and reclaiming a language, we're adding another layer that really distorts my view of what I need to be doing in the here and now. Anytime I make a decision that's exclusive of diversity, I need to raise a red flag and ask myself, what am I doing? The spiritual journey for Unitarian Universalism, just as it was for Julia Ward Howe, even though it was a thankless position where she was ridiculed, and when we look at Unitarian Universalists through time, we just don't see thankless, ridiculed. We have Unitarian Universalists that were burned at the stake. We have Unitarian Universalists that were murdered for their positions. We had Unitarian Universalists that were walking in the forefront of the civil rights movement who were killed. Unitarian Universalism, we can find a spiritual thread in Unitarian Universalism. When people came up against the worldview, they did not retreat into what once was.
They said, no, we have to step past our worldview and we have to create another worldview for us to live in and for us to dwell. And that is our spiritual journey. And it seems to me, as Unitarian Universalists, if we want to carry that legacy on, we need to look in a different direction rather than back. And we need to look at, and we need to look past the worldview that we have now to see if we can come up with something different, something new, something that has not yet existed. And that's the meaning of Unitarian Universalists.